Chapter 25, In Sight of Suribachi. Can't be as rough as it was on Tarawa. No way as hard as it was taking Peleliu. After the canal, this will be a piece of cake. Those are some of the things my marine buddies said on our way to Iwo Jima. They'd been through the fighting that made those other Pacific islands feel like little bits of hell on earth. They'd struggled out of sinking landing craft, stormed the beaches while machine gun fire tore up the sand around their feet, heard the terrible sound of air being ripped apart around them by pieces of whirling metal, seen buddies killed right next to them. There was no way this little piece of volcanic garbage could be as bad as what they'd been through. They were right. Iwo Jima wasn't like those other landings that seemed like bad dreams. It was the worst nightmare of all. It wasn't the fault of our commanders. Iwo Jima wasn't just softened up for a few days before D-Day. It was pulverized. For 5 months, heavy bombs dropped on that little island almost every minute. Hour after hour, for days on end, high explosives poured from the sky like metal rain. It seemed impossible that anything could survive. What command didn't know was how deep the enemy had dug into the island. Those thousands of tons of bombs didn't do much more than disturb the sleep of the Japanese soldiers in reinforced caves and tunnels 100 feet below the black sand. They were well supplied, too. They had distilleries set up to make drinking water and stocks of food enough to last for years. In fact, grandchildren, when we finally took that island and began exploring the deserted Japanese positions, we Marines found something that made us feel especially angry. We were looking through a cave when the beam of my flashlight caught the glint of metal. "I cannot believe this," I said. "Well, I'll be danged," Georgia Boy said. There, stacked from floor to ceiling, were thousands and thousands of boxes of canned goods. There was everything from beans and meat to fruit cocktail, just like those canned goods we Navajos had gotten together on our food drive to help the poor earthquake victims. All of those cases were clearly marked on the side in English. USA Food Relief. It was indeed the very same food donated by Americans to Japan before the war. The Japanese military government had stolen it from their own hungry people. The 5th fleet that Admiral Spruance sent in against Iwo Jima was the largest one that had ever sailed the Pacific. 12 aircraft carriers and 44 destroyers, 44 transport ships, 30 minesweepers, and many other vessels. 464 ships in all. Our fleet was so big that there were 4 command ships, each with its own team of Navajo code talkers. There were also non-Navajo teams sending and receiving messages in Morse code on the command ships and among the landing forces. However, all the messages sent by Morse code were false, designed to fool any Japanese monitoring our transmissions. Everything important was run through our Navajo net. The 5th Marine Amphibious Corps was also the largest landing force in the history of the Marines. 3 reinforced divisions, 70,000 men in all. The 4th and the 5th would lead the attack. On February 19, 1945, at about 0100, the major part of our fleet dropped anchor 4,000 yards off the shore of Iwo Jima. 3rd Division waited 50 miles to the southeast. It would only be called for if it was desperately needed. That need came far sooner than expected. Breakfast was to be served at about 0500. Before then, though, I made my way quietly to the upper deck. I knew other code talkers were doing the same on the command ships and the other transports. I stood with nothing over my head but the sky. I faced the east, took a pinch of pollen from my pouch, and placed it on my tongue. I put a little dab of pollen on top of my head and spoke my words to the holy people. "Let me have clear thoughts, clear speech, and a good path to walk this day," I prayed, as I watched the rising sun. Breakfast, as always, was a big one. There was a tradition back then of serving every Marine a T-bone steak, eggs, and biscuits, with lots of gravy, and as much coffee as he could drink before getting onto his landing craft. The idea was that a Marine needed the energy from that food to go into battle. "Enjoy your last meal, Leatherneck," said the cook who served me. I smiled and nodded to him. It was part of a ritual our cooks followed. Calling it our last meal was a way of wishing us good luck. Most Marines ate as much as they could of that big breakfast, but not me. Instead, I took 2 big slices of bread, stuck my steak in between them, wrapped it up, and stashed it in my combat pack. I had plenty of reasons for doing that. I wasn't feeling hungry yet. Plus, I had seen what happened to a lot of those big breakfasts eaten by keyed-up Marines who had to get into boats being rocked back and forth by the waves. You learned not to stand in front of a jarhead whose face was turning green. His breakfast was about to become fish food. Another reason for not eating before heading into combat was something no one wanted to talk about. It was better to take a bullet in your guts on an empty stomach. The medics knew that and did what I did. Stashed breakfast in their packs, or just didn't eat. My main reason, though, for packing away that steak was that I figured I'd need it later. I'd learned what it was like to be pinned down in a foxhole for hours on end, with nothing to chew on but your last sea rations. If that happened on Iwo, I'd be happy to have a steak sandwich in my pack. As I stood on deck, waiting, ready to climb into the LST, I got my first look at Iwo Jima, appearing in the faint light before dawn. The looming shape of Suribachi made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. That mountain rose like the shadow of a monster against the dark sky. At 06:30, the guns of our support ships began to roar. Fire shot out of the cannons of the Idaho, the Nevada, the New York, and the Tennessee. Our bombardment tore up the beaches and the slopes of Suribachi, but there was no answering fire from the shore. Waves of airplanes swept in, Marine Corsair F-4Us. They blanketed just about every square foot with rockets and fire. Smoke filled the air, and the hot breeze from the island brought the scent of the napalm to us. But there was no response. It was like the whole island was dead. Some of us dared to hope that the Japanese defenses had been wiped out by our guns and during the months of bombing. But I remembered the words General Howling Mad Smith spoke at the meeting. He'd been the only commander with serious doubts about the plan. "This will be the bloodiest fight in Marine Corps history," he said. "We'll catch 7 kinds of hell on the beaches, and that will be just the beginning. The fighting will be fierce, and the casualties will be awful, but my Marines will take the damned island." My new Signal Corps group was with the first wave. Most of the non-Navajo men were guys I just met. Georgia Boy had been assigned to another company in the second wave. Smitty, though, was right beside me. Smitty and I had reached a point where we felt as if we were each other's good luck charm. As long as we stuck together in battle, nothing too bad could happen to either of us. Our LSTs moved up to the line of departure at 07:30, and our amphibious alligators rolled down the ramp into the water. Unlike the first alligators we used on Bougainville, they were more heavily armored all around. Also, each alligator had 3 machine guns and a 75mm howitzer. After unloading us on the beach, our alligators were supposed to crawl inland another 50 yards to form a line of fire protecting the men who came after us. 08:30. The central control vessel dipped her pennant. The 68 alligators of our 2nd Armored Amphibian Battalion crossed the lines of departure. 5 minutes behind us was the second wave. Then the third, the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth. As so often happened, a nervous Marine behind me started checking his watch and calling out the time. 5 minutes, he said. Then, 6 minutes. 7. I could feel it getting warmer as we got closer to the island. Mount Suribachi kept getting larger above us as we continued in. 10 minutes. 11. I thought at first that the growing warmth was only nervousness, or my imagination as I remembered General Smith's words about hell. But heat actually was coming from the island itself. Iwo Jima had been made by volcanoes. Its name, which means sulfur island, is an appropriate one. The closer you got, the hotter it was. When we arrived on the island, we'd see cracks in the rock where steam rose up. If you pushed your hand down too far into the loose sand, your skin would be burned. 15 minutes. 16. At 0906, our alligator ground onto the black sand. The ramp, which had the words, "Welcome to Paradise," printed on it in big block letters, dropped. "Go!" our lieutenant, who was in the boat with us, yelled. "Don't bunch up on the beach!" We poured out, expecting our welcome to be mortars and machine guns. Instead, as our feet sank ankle deep in the black sand, the only fire we heard was from our own guns out to sea. The four battleships had adjusted their range. The slopes 500 yards ahead of us were being blanketed with bursting shells that threw up geysers of fiery sand. Our second wave landed, and then our third. There was still no sign of any enemy. 0910. 0915. 0930. All 9,000 Marines of our first wave were on the beach, ready to move up the steep terraces toward Mount Suribachi and the two airfields on the plateau in the middle of the hilly island. It had been all too easy. I adjusted the strap of my radio over my shoulder and shook my head as I peered up at the mountain. It seemed to be staring down at me, the way a cougar watches a deer before it attacks. "Hey," Smitty said to me, "this is like a walk in the park, Chief." Then, the Japanese sprung their trap.
This ends Disc 4.